This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It seems like every other day, someone in the media is talking about the American education system being broken. They say it, and everyone nods in agreement. But one of the foremost authorities on education in the U.S. says that public schools are doing fine. The real problem is the growing trend towards privatization.
Kids are not getting a better education, but some people who run these companies are getting very rich.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch, who calls the privatization movement a reign of error. We'll also spend an academic minute with a visit from some crazy aunts, and we're not talking about the kind that show up for the holidays with fruitcake. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. America's schools are not failing and not declining, but they are in crisis. In her best-selling book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools, Diane Ravitch says the country's schools are performing better. Graduation rates are at an all-time high, dropout rates at all-time lows, and test scores continue to rise. The crisis comes from the draining of money for public schools by privatization. Diane Ravitch is a former Assistant Secretary of Education for the first President Bush and was also appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Clinton. She's now an historian of education at New York University. I spoke to Dr. Ravitch about her book and what she means by the privatization movement. It's not like Walmart's opening schools.
Well, sometimes we are talking about Walmart schools. Privatization, in my view, is when the public, for whatever reasons, decides to hand over control to a private board of trustees. Sometimes they're operating for profit, sometimes they're not for profit, but the public loses control. The school then, instead of being a public school that accepts everybody who walks through the door, decides who it wants to accept, excludes kids, kicks kids out, sets its own discipline rules, and this is what we see happening with the charter school movement. And there are some people getting very rich from the charter school movement. And there are some charter schools that are doing very terribly, but they give money to politicians to stay open.
And with privatization, are charter schools primarily what we're talking about?
Privatization includes, in my book, basically three different formats. One is vouchers, where you give kids, and Florida does this with different kinds of kids. They get some state money, and they can go to a religious school or any school they want to go to, private or usually private or religious. That's one form of privatization. Charter schools right now, I think, are the most aggressive form of privatization because they're taking public dollars away from public schools, which have Democratic control, and transferring them over in many cases, especially in Florida and Ohio and Michigan and some other states. They're going to for-profit firms. So kids are not getting a better education, but some people who run these companies, these charter companies, are getting very rich.
One of the big things we hear, and everybody just kind of nods their head and says, well, of course, that's right, or today's schools are failing. Is that really true?
No, it's not true at all. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book, Reign of Error, is that this is absolutely not true. I have charts and charts all taken from the U.S. Department of Education website that show that test scores in the United States have never been higher than they are today. They're the highest ever since we've been keeping these records for about the last 40 years. For white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and Asian kids, graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in our history. And the dropout rates today are the lowest they've ever been in our history. So our schools are doing incredibly well, considering the obstacles that they face, the obstacles being, in some states, very deep budget cuts, very large numbers of kids who don't speak English and come to public school and have to learn English, and significant numbers of children with disabilities who require a lot of extra money and a lot of extra help.
In the book, you refer to the American education system as a patchwork quilt. Isn't that really one central system? Explain what you mean by that.
Well, American education has always been organized by state and by local school district. We have a very long historic tradition of local control and state control. 90% of the cost of education comes from state and local sources. The federal government only puts up 10%. So the state has always been the biggest supplier of funding between states and local districts. And it's, in that sense, it's a patchwork quilt. We don't have one system where everybody does the same thing at the same time. There's a move underway today called the Common Core Standards, so that everybody, there would be standardization across the United States, and everybody would take the same test and study the same materials. I'm not a supporter of the Common Core Standards. I don't think it's a good idea. I think that one of the great strengths of our country has been diversity, individualism, non-standardization, and I don't think there's strength in standardization.
I would think that just having a standard that you'd like to a kid in Mississippi to have the same knowledge out of high school as a kid in Massachusetts.
Well, we already know how to compare the children in Mississippi and the children in Massachusetts. The federal government has a test that it gives every couple of years called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And the math is the same for kids across the country. The reading is the same. And it's not specific in the sense that everybody has to have the same textbooks. But the tests are given, and we know that the kids in Mississippi are far behind the kids in Massachusetts. The reason for that is not because they're using different textbooks, but because Massachusetts is a much wealthier state. Wherever you find poverty, you find low test scores. I mean, if you wanted to predict what the test scores will be in any school district, just ask what are the demographics, what's the poverty rate. I think what's going on right now across the country is there is a huge corporate assault on public education, an effort to privatize it and to find ways to make money. I think the Common Core is part of this corporate assault, because states and school districts will be required to spend literally billions of dollars on new technology. All the tests will be given online, which is a huge boon for the technology industry, and it's also a boon for the testing companies. But, you know, you could have the highest standards in the world, and that doesn't mean you're going to have higher performance. It's not the standards that cause high performance. It is, first of all, families supporting their kids, and secondly, having really well-prepared, well-trained, experienced teachers. And what you'll find, again, if you look anywhere in this country, is that where there's high poverty, there are low test scores.
One of the arguments you hear for some privatization is that, you know, there is a lot of poverty in this neighborhood, so we'll give you vouchers so the kids can go to a better school.
Actually, it turns out, and there's now a lot of research that's been done on vouchers, most of the voucher schools are just under-resourced religious schools. Some of them are operating in basements, and they're not very good schools. They don't have a curriculum. And, you know, when people on the one hand talk about standards, and on the other hand say, well, we'll give kids vouchers so that they can go to some pathetic little school in the backwoods, that's what has happened, for example, in Louisiana. Kids get vouchers and they go to these religious schools that don't have certified teachers, that don't have a curriculum, and that are teaching kids from DVDs. That's not about improving education. That's just about handing out money and trying to make some political capital from it.
You do talk about some of the widespread disdain in the country that's grown for the teaching profession and seeking out non-educators for leadership positions in school boards. When did this start, and how bad is it getting?
Well, I think we have a very serious problem in this country with the constant sniping at teachers. I happen to have the greatest respect for people who are public school teachers. I know that in most states, most teachers have a master's degree. They're well prepared. But in recent years, we've seen a lot of very good teachers leaving because, first of all, they're not well paid compared to the other professions where the people have the same amount of education. And secondly, teachers today don't have the respect of their community, and that is outrageous. There are many school districts that are hiring inexperienced teachers because they're cheaper, and there's an organization called Teach for America, which sounds very idealistic. It's kind of like the Peace Corps, but they're sending in young college graduates to be teachers in very hard-pressed, poor schools, and these kids only have 5 weeks of training. And as I say in the addition to my book, this is a bit of a hoax to think that you're improving the teaching profession by having inexperienced people teaching kids who have really do need experienced teachers.
But what about having non-educators on school boards? Some would say it's good to have someone from outside the industry having a fresh look at it.
Well, I think it's a good thing to have a school board that includes members of the community. In that sense, it's good to have businessmen on a school board. It's good to have some educators. I don't think that school boards should be dominated by educators, but I think it's good to have a mix of people from the community so that there are parents. The main thing about school boards is they should be committed to the improvement of the public schools. What I have noticed in a number of communities is that people are running for school board in order to hand the public schools over to private entities. And that's a kind of, that's almost like subversion. I think that school boards should be committed to the children of their community, committed to this great democratic institution called public education. And I know that Florida is one state where the privatizers have really run amok. They hold many very important positions in the legislature. People representing the charter school industry, which makes a lot of money in Florida, hold very important positions in the state legislature. I think that's really undermining public education. And, you know, 87 to 90% of the kids in this country go to public schools. We should want them to get better and not undermine them. Competition does not make schools better. It just sucks money out of the public schools, and it ends up in somebody's pocket.
And you look at what's gone on in some of the Texas school boards where they really just got there to completely put an agenda on the curriculum.
Well, that's true. There are states, Texas is one of them, where people want to have the curriculum reflect their personal views, their political views. It's true in Colorado as well. There are a number of states where people run for the school board because they have a strong political agenda. And I think that they should listen to their teachers. I mean, the reason you hire teachers is they're expert in their field. They're expert as historians, as students of history. They're scientists. They're people who are knowledgeable about literature. And you don't want the local school board to be making decisions where they tell teachers what to teach.
Still to come, our conversation with Diane Ravitch about her book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools, continues with a look at other issues in the book, such as merit pay for teachers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1256. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Diane Ravitch, a former Assistant Secretary of Education. She's now an historian of education at New York University. We're talking about her book, which is now in paperback, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. You don't have a high opinion of merit pay, if I read your book correctly. What's wrong with rewarding merit?
Well, because when we talk about merit pay, what we're really talking about is paying people more if test scores go up. And that's not merit. Meritorious teachers may be teaching the hardest to educate children. They may be teaching the kids who have disabilities who don't get high test scores. So when you hand out money to get higher test scores, first of all, it doesn't work. And what I show in the book is there has been, we've tried in this country merit pay for over 100 years. It has never worked. It is a very arbitrary way of handing out money, and it doesn't make teachers work harder. They're already working as hard as they know how, and it doesn't even lead to higher test scores, again, because teachers are working as hard as they know how. And when you put that much emphasis on test scores and say, we're going to pay you for higher scores, you get scandals. You get cheating. I mean, there's a trial going on right now in Georgia, a massive cheating scandal because so much emphasis was placed on test scores. I think that in the best schools, test scores are simply one among many, many measures of what makes for good teachers and what makes for good students.
This spring, I spoke to John Kuhn about his book, Fear and Learning in America, which had a very nice foreword written by you. He told the same story that you do in the book about blueberries.
Right. That's a famous story where a businessman says to a group of educators, he says, you know, you people don't know how to make quality. And he said, my business is making ice cream, and the way to make great ice cream is you get the best materials. And somebody innocently stood up and said, well, what if you get a shipment of rotten blueberries? He said, well, I throw that shipment out and wait for the best blueberries. And, of course, everyone in the audience started yelling and saying, we can't throw any blueberries away. Our children, we have to take them as they come. We have to take them with disabilities. We have to take them if they're blind or if they're deaf or if they don't speak English. Whatever however they come, we keep all the blueberries. And that's why the business approach simply doesn't work if you think you can only take the kids you want. And that's one of the great secrets of the charter movement, is that they take the kids they want. And every time I've looked at a successful charter school, if you think that success means high test scores, what they've done is to exclude the kids who are English language learners, exclude the kids who have disabilities that might affect their test scores, and kick out the kids who get low test scores. And then as kids drop out, they don't replace them. So one of the very high-flying charter chains that I looked at, they'll have 130 kids in third grade, but by the time eighth grade rolls around, there are only 35 kids left. They haven't replaced them with newcomers. Now, in a public school, if a child arrives in February, you have to take them. You can't turn them away and say, sorry, we don't take newcomers. If a child arrives and they have a serious disability, you must take them. That's the law. The law is on their side. So we are, I think, the great risk, and this is what I try to point to in the book, is that we may be developing right now a dual school system. Now, before the Brown decision in 1954, we had a dual school system based on race, one for blacks, one for whites, and they were separate and unequal. What we're doing now with the charters is to create a dual school system. The charters are allowed to accept only the students they want to accept, and this is true for almost all charters. They're allowed to set their own discipline rules and expel kids or suspend kids whenever they want. And so they end up accepting only the kids they want, whereas the other system, the public system, has to take everyone. And that's a dual school system, and that's not American.
And it seems like when you take only the kids you want, you don't have to work that hard because you're taking the ones who are going to learn no matter what you do.
Well, that's the whole idea, is if test scores are all that count, then you make a point of excluding or kicking out the kids who are not going to get the high scores. I know that we've heard over the past few years about the New Orleans miracle. Well, there is no New Orleans miracle. All the schools in New Orleans are charter schools, and the ones with high test scores have a selective admissions, and the others are all graded by the state, either a D or an F. So there's no miracle there. New Orleans is one of the lowest performing districts in the state of Louisiana, and charters have not created a miracle district.
Looking around the country, who's doing it right?
Well, you know what, and this is a sad thing, Bob. We have federal policy that forces everyone around the country to do it wrong. Now, there are a few districts that struggle to buck the federal policy, and in fact, there's a huge movement today among parents to fight federal policy, but we have a federal law. One is called No Child Left Behind, which is George W. Bush's law, and that law says test every child every year. That's wrong. There's not another country, at least none of the high-performing countries in the world, test every child every year. Kids may take tests three times in their whole school career in most of these high-performing countries. No Child Left Behind has focused all the schools in this country on testing, and you break the law if you don't go along with that. Then there's Arne Duncan and Barack Obama's Race to the Top. That's just more of No Child Left Behind, which is to tie teachers' evaluation to the test scores of their children, to open more charter schools, and it's simply, again, test scores are everything. We are going in the wrong direction. So I argue in the book, we have great public schools in this country, and they are being ruined, first of all, by No Child Left Behind, and secondly, by Race to the Top. These are two terrible programs that put far too much emphasis on standardized testing, far too much emphasis on ranking and rating children, because every child is different, and we have to think of children as our citizens, as people, each of whom has different talents, different needs, different strengths. They all deserve a good education, and we should give each and every one of them the best possible education we can. We have a lot of work to do in this country to have the education system that we need and that we deserve, but our federal policy is pushing us totally in the wrong direction.
Without testing, what do we do to find out if a student is where a student should be?
Well, I think that the best tests are the tests given by teachers. What's wrong with standardized testing, and this is happening all over the country, it's a huge money pit for two companies, Pearson, which is a British company, which is making billions of dollars from testing, and McGraw-Hill, which is an American company. There are a couple of other small companies, but basically what's happening with Common Core testing and with all of the standardized testing is when the scores come back, the teachers are not allowed to see the questions. So the whole purpose of testing is to find out whether the kids actually learned what you taught, but you're not allowed to find out what they learned and what they didn't learn. So what's the point of the testing? The whole point of it is just to rank them, grade them, and rate them, and learn nothing about what their needs are. So the best tests are the ones the teachers give, and then the kind of state testing which is given on a sampling basis, like the national testing, where we can say, you know, what's working and what's not working.
Again, the name of Diane Ravitch's book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. It's now out in paperback from Vintage Books. Remember some years back the invasion of the killer bees that slowly made its way into North America? Well, don't look now, but here come the crazy ants. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I am Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The southeastern United States is currently overrun with crazy ants. Edward LeBrun, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Texas at Austin's Department of Integrative Biology, links this invasive trend to the ants' highly effective venom.
Tawny crazy ants are invading the southeastern United States. They reach enormous densities, causing big headaches for residents. They also reduce the abundance and alter the composition of the native insect fauna, threatening the integrity of local food webs. Crazy ants were first reported in the southeast around 2000. However, they were preceded by another damaging ant invader, imported fire ants. It turns out that tawny crazy ants and imported fire ants both evolved in the floodplains of Central South America, competing with each other for millions of years. The success of crazy ants in the U.S. arises in part from the fact that high-density populations are displacing imported fire ants. Fire ants are remarkably tough competitors. How do crazy ants do this? Many ant species engage in chemical warfare, secreting a diverse array of defensive compounds. Fire ants flick or smear a venom 2 to 3 times more toxic than the insecticide DDT onto competitors. We recently discovered that crazy ants have a secret weapon in their war against fire ants. They can detoxify fire ant venom. To do this, crazy ants carefully apply their own venom, concentrated formic acid, to the areas of their bodies exposed to fire ant venom. This chemical countermeasure is almost 100% effective, so effective that crazy ants will grab droplets of venom off of the tips of their enemy's stingers, disarming their opponents. Crazy ants and fire ants have been in contact in the U.S. for only a blink of evolutionary time. So both this feat of detoxification and the invasion occurring in people's backyards results from millions of years of conflict and evolution in the swampy savannas of South America. Both plants and bacteria were known to engage in this sort of detoxifying chemical interaction with competitors, but crazy ants provide the first animal example of this phenomenon.
That was Edward LeBrun of the University of Texas at Austin. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.